was homeward bound one night on the deep. Swinging in my hammock, I fell asleep. I dreamed a dream and I thought it true, concerning Franklin and his gallant crew.
Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of the Talking Newspaper for St. Albans, Harpenden, and the surrounding area.
With 100 seamen, he sailed away.
I'm Bill Redway, and this is the Red Satin programme for the week ending Saturday, the 19th of October, 2019, which also happens to be my 70th birthday. Now, I may have given the impression over the past year or so that I have a particular fondness for folk music of various kinds. We've been fortunate that many leading folk performers have kindly allowed us to play their music on the show without charge. This week I'm playing a song that doesn't require anyone's permission, as it's a traditional piece and I'm playing it myself. It's called Lord Franklin, and it's about the Franklin Expedition, which set sail in 1845 to try to discover the Northwest Passage from the Atlantic to the Pacific. The two ships and all their men were tragically lost without trace. The song was revived about 50 years ago by the folk group Pentangle. This is my version, and I do hope you enjoy it. As usual, I'll play it in full at the end of the programme. This week, of course, we have the latest news stories from the current edition of the Hearts Advertiser, followed by suggested listings of programmes on national radio that might be of interest to you over the next 7 days, courtesy of Sue once again. In part two, local writer and teacher Claire Hobber tells Rob Pearman why she wanted to talk about Man Booker 2018 prize winner Milkman. And in part three, we have a story from Hertfordshire Life magazine about Cresta Silks, which was founded in Welwyn Garden City 90 years ago. We start with the news, and our readers today are Hilary, Caroline, Bob, and Lucy.
Hello there, it's Hilary here, and my first story is about how too many patients are having to endure lengthy waiting times at A&E at Watford General Hospital. National guidelines dictate that 95% of all patients should be admitted, discharged, or transferred within 4 hours of arrival at A&E. However, the latest data shows that in May, just 79.9% of patients were treated within the target time at Watford, meaning one in five patients were there for more than 4 hours. Taking data from April into account, the percentage of patients being treated within 4 hours was slightly higher, at 80.5%. The report also notes the decline in A&E performance at Watford General since the same time last year, when it was running at 86.1%. The data was presented to a meeting of the Hearts Valley's Clinical Commissioning Group's board at the end of last month. After the meeting, a spokesperson pointed to the 7.6% increase in the number of patients arriving at A&E in April and September compared to the same time last year, meaning an additional 3,729 patients. The spokesperson said, "Behind the figures, it's important to note that hospital staff work very hard to ensure the safety and comfort of patients. Patients are assessed on arrival, so that if needed, they can receive antibiotics, fluids and pain relief within a few minutes of arrival by ambulance, and are clinically assessed and prioritised so that those with the most serious conditions are seen soonest." The CCG is now monitoring waiting times at A&E several times a day, and are working closely with West Hearts Hospitals Trust to reduce the wait. New hospital campaigner Andy Love said, "Watford General not meeting the A&E national guidelines is totally unacceptable, and the figures probably don't include those who decided not to wait, having been made aware of the waiting time." With 150,000 residents expected to move into the West Hearts catchment area over the next 10 to 15 years, it only highlights the need for more capacity at our only A&E hospital, and only a new build in a more central West Hearts location will adequately provide for this. The doctors and nurses must feel very stressed having to cope in such circumstances.
Hello, this is Lucy here, and my first article is about a mum who raised thousands of pounds for the Mind charity in memory of her daughter, who very sadly took her own life. Leander Kelly organised a musical tribute night to raise money in honour of her daughter Tania Kordek, who died on December the 17th at the age of 44. The event, named Tribute to TK, was held at London Road Club on October the 5th, with multiple singers and DJs agreeing to take part free of charge. There were three rooms, a Soul Train room featuring DJs and singers, a Tarnmania room featuring house, dance and garage music, and a third room with musician Jenny Pepper playing music and taking photos. Ticket sales raised £4,100, and a raffle, which is continuing until Saturday, has so far raised £2,100. Of the total, £1,050 was donated to Lynn Dutton from St Albans Action for Homeless, and the rest will be donated to mental health charity Mind in Mid-Hearts. Tania was born in St Albans City Hospital and lived in Brickett Wood at the time of her death. Leander said, "Tania suffered with an eating disorder, was diagnosed with bipolar and hid herself away a lot. She went to live in Parma after losing her partner to alcohol, and she stayed with a friend who used her vulnerability to his advantage, eventually beating her so badly she ended up in hospital for 13 weeks under police protection. Eventually I got her home and tried my hardest to keep her safe and see life was worth living. She didn't want to live anymore. My cries for help were not listened to. My sons have lost their sister, and my grandchildren and great-grandchildren have lost the most beautiful, caring auntie. I decided I wanted to do something to help others who feel like she did. Nobody should feel the way I now feel. If we can just help one person, then that's a good thing." Leander thanked her husband Dickie for his support, calling him a fantastic stepdad and granddad, and also thanked Stevie McFarland for helping organise the event, the DJs and musicians who gave their time for free. She plans to turn tonight into an annual fundraising event. Mind in Mid-Hearts provides mental health support for people aged 16 and over. The charity has wellbeing centres based in St Albans, Welwyn Hatfield and Stevenage, and supports positive mental health through prevention, social support and recovery.
Hi, it's Bob here. Airport consultation reaches final phase. Time is running out for the district's residents to have their say on Luton Airport's expansion plans to accommodate more passengers. Luton Borough Council's airport company, London Luton Airport Limited, started its latest consultation yesterday with a series of 34 consultation events taking place across the region. The events will take place between October 25th and December the 7th, and members of the public will have the opportunity to look at the plans, speak with members of the project team, and provide their views before consultation closes on December the 16th. Following feedback received during the first consultation in summer 2018, LLAL is proposing sustainable phased growth of the airport to 32 million passengers per annum by 2039. This will involve providing a second terminal north of the runway and extensive new airfield infrastructure. Also proposed are a third station and extension for the Luton Dart fast transit from Luton Airport Parkway Station to the new terminal, plus on and off-site highway improvements. LLAL is also proposing a new incremental funding package, which would provide up to an additional £40 million a year at 32 million passengers per annum for the local communities most impacted by airport operations. They are not proposing any changes to the existing single runway or any increase in the number of night flights currently permitted between 11:30 p.m. and 6 a.m. Chief Executive of Luton Borough Council, Robin Porter, said the airport is a key driver for economic growth and prosperity in the region. He said the proposed development would deliver enormous benefits, including an estimated 16,000 new jobs, with around a third of those directly employed at the airport. St Albans MP Anne Main opposes the expansion plan, describing the situation as intolerable. She said the judge and jury arrangement between Luton Borough Council and the airport has meant that residents feel they have no voice and whatever they do doesn't make a difference. Luton has quickly exceeded their previous passenger number estimates and they will no doubt do that again if this expansion is granted. Full details of the consultation are available at www.futureluton.llal.org.uk, and there's a picture of an EasyJet plane taking off from Luton Airport.
Hello, I'm Caroline, and my first story is about a pregnant woman's struggle to get home from a happy holiday. A pregnant St Albans woman and her family were left stranded in Italy after the airline would not allow her to fly home. Katie Plummer, her partner Giorgio Lamanaca, and their three-year-old daughter Enya were not allowed to fly from Bari Carol Vocula Airport in Italy on Friday, September the 20th, because Katie was 31 weeks pregnant. The couple flew with Wizz Air and were not told that they needed a fit-to-fly document, which is recommended from 28 weeks gestation. They were allowed to fly from Luton Airport to Bari with no documentation, but were stopped at Bari Airport before their return journey 5 days later. Giorgio said, Katie was standing at the departure gate, waiting for confirmation from the pilot that she could fly. They left her at the desk with everyone on the plane waiting for his decision. Katie made it very clear that she is not a high-risk pregnancy and would sign to take full responsibility for any risk. At this point, she was hysterically crying at the prospect of being left in Italy with no return flight. Myself and my daughter were advised to get on the plane. Our buggy was on there and our hand luggage. Katie wrote and signed a full written statement claiming responsibility for herself on the flight, which was witnessed and photographed by airport staff. The family were then allowed onto the plane, but the pilot would not accept the document and argued it would be accepted in Italy, but not in the UK, refusing to fly with Katie on board. In front of the whole plane, the pilot refused to fly Katie home, saying he would not take the risk, Giorgio said, which is ludicrous, considering the amount of stress, upset and trauma he put her and my toddler through during this whole ordeal, a risk far greater than a flight. The couple were escorted from the plane and felt pressured into booking return flights home the following Wednesday. They found a hotel for the night but were worried they would be refused permission to fly again. Giorgio said, at this point, Katie was extremely anxious, not only about the cost, the loss of earning from having to miss work and the uncertainty of the next 5 days, but the risk of all this on our unborn baby. We felt stuck in a corner with no help at all from any of the staff involved, alone and lost. Katie decided she wanted to get home immediately as she was worried any extra stress would be damaging for the baby. The family ended up taking a train at 6:35 a.m. the next day from Bari to Milan, then another train to Paris, taking 16 hours and costing £422. From there, they took a coach to London Victoria, costing another £80. They had no time to get food for their journey other than chocolate and crisps. Enya was sick on the overnight coach, and Katie had to run to catch the coach from Paris at 11:30 p.m. as their train was delayed. Giorgio added, "The whole ordeal was traumatic, disgusting, and completely unnecessary. We accept that we were unaware of the policy to have a medical certificate from 28 weeks, which we did not assume we would be needed, as Katie was not a high-risk pregnancy with no medical history. If Wizz Air had followed their own policy, which they were so adamant to enforce on September the 20th, then Katie would never have flown out to Italy from Luton 5 days previously to be left distressed, distraught, stressed and stranded with no support over a 2.5 hour flight she was capable and perfectly fit to fly. Instead, she undertook a 40-hour traumatic journey across Europe with a toddler, no money and no access to a proper meal." A statement from Wizz Air said, "Wizz Air is sorry to hear of the inconvenience the passenger in question experienced as a result of not having the correct medical certification to approve her fitness to travel by air. Our policy, as stated on the website and within Wizz Air's general conditions of carriage, requires pregnant women over their 28th week of pregnancy to provide a medical certificate in order to fly. Without this, the captain of the flight can make the final decision on whether Wizz Air's strict regulations for passenger safety can be met. In this instance, this was deemed not to be the case. The safety of our passengers remains our number one priority, and therefore we strongly recommend all passengers check the Wizz Air website if they have any questions about their suitability for travel ahead of their flight. And the article is accompanied by a picture of the three of them, Giorgio, Katie and Enya, sitting by the seaside in much happier times.
A Harbenden woman diagnosed with breast cancer aged just 42 has written a book offering advice to women in the same situation. Sarah Lionage, now 45, set up the Ticking Off Breast Cancer website in November 2017, towards the end of her treatment, writing about her experiences of juggling her diagnosis, her job, and being a married mum of two. She said, "I didn't know anyone who had breast cancer. 42 is quite young to get it. I set up a website with practical advice for women going through breast cancer treatment and their friends and families. I found putting together the website really therapeutic because it's not just about me, it's about helping others by using my experience. I started to write about what happened to me personally. It's a huge shock to go through something like cancer, and everyone deals with it in a different way, and my way was writing. The book, also called Ticking Off Breast Cancer, chronicles Sarah's life from the day of diagnosis and throughout her treatment, with accompanying to-do lists at the end of each chapter. These lists offer tips and advice for people with cancer, as well as details of ways family and friends can offer practical help and support. Sarah said, "What I'm saying in my book won't be the same for everyone, but what I wanted to say is you're not alone in what you're going through. It's a way of coping together. I know people find comfort in reading personal accounts. It's like talking to somebody, especially for people with cancer under the age of 55 who don't have that network." Sora works part-time as a lawyer and has two children, aged 12 and 14, and when she joined support groups for people with breast cancer, she always found she was the youngest person there, so wanted to write the book for other women of a similar age. She said, "I would really like friends and family to read the book and get an insight into living with breast cancer treatment. It's so hard to know what to do. My sister said she wished she'd had the book when I was going through it. It's really lovely to get messages from people who say that it's helped them."
An article now about an author duo who have written a new book revealing milestone menus from over the millennia. Do you know what Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin ate after landing on the moon? Or how the last meal served on RMS Titanic dramatically differed between the classes? Or what was served up at Elvis Presley's wedding breakfast? The answers are served up in Menus That Made History, a new book from an unlikely pairing of St Albans authors, who conceived the concept over a few games of snooker. Independent journalist Alex Johnson is well known for his ongoing mission to promote shed working, but has also penned works on improbable libraries, towns made famous by their plethora of bookshops, the pets of famous writers, and a fun and informative look at bookshelf design. He's joined in his latest endeavour by actor Vince Franklin, who has been seen on screen in the likes of Bodyguard, Happy Valley, The Thick of It, and Gentleman Jack. The two old friends and neighbours devised their collaboration after discussing Alex's previous work, A Book of Book Lists, which featured lists including what books IKEA uses as display props and what was on Bin Laden's bookshelf. Vince suggested they do something similar about interesting menus, revealing the stories behind the dishes. They put together a collection of the world's 75 most iconic menus, revealing not only the story of food, but also casting a new eye over periods of history, famous works of literature, notable events, and celebrity figures from prehistoric times to the present day. Alex explained what the book aims to do. For me, one of the most interesting segments of the early series of The Great British Bake Off was when Mel and Sue looked into the history of the dishes the contestants were making. I hope this book provides something similar, including a few terrible jokes, some intriguing insight into famous meals and events, plus some amazing facts to entertain your family and friends with. Vince revealed his favourite menus. It's difficult to pick just one or two, but it's fascinating to see what a fish and chips menu can tell us about the industrialisation of Britain, how Parisians were forced to eat their own zoo, and why George IV's guests ended up hurling capons at his coronation banquet. While I was first drawn to those menus that included the most extraordinary food, roast heron or supreme of narwhal, in the end it's the ones that have great stories behind them that proved the most satisfying. It's hard not to develop a soft spot for a man who travelled halfway around the world to open Britain's first Indian restaurant and ended up working for two kings. Menus That Made History is available from all good bookshops, including St Albans Waterstones.
Pressure put on Environment Agency to save River Ver after sustained dry spell. Councillors are putting pressure on the Environment Agency to save the dried-up River Ver in St Albans. The River Ver is a chalk stream running through Markyate, Flamstead, Redbourne, St Albans and Park Street, and environmental campaigners from the Ver Valley Society have held demonstrations to protest its lack of water. In a St Albans District Council meeting last week, councillors demanded effective action to reduce the abstraction of water from the riverbed. Speaking after the debate, Councillor Anthony Rowlands, who chairs the River Ver and Verulamium Lake Working Group, said, "It is absolutely crucial that the Environment Agency takes effective steps to ensure that the River Ver recovers along its whole length. We need the agency to commit funding for the project to revitalise the river from St Michael's to Cotton Mill. The agency has already demonstrated support for the project by funding the design stages and some early tree work, but we need them to commit funding for the whole project. That's why we wanted to send the strongest possible message to both the Secretary of State and the Environment Agency. It is about putting pressure on those who hold the purse strings. Affinity Water abstracts tens of millions of litres of water per day from the River Ver aquifer, an underground layer of water-bearing permeable rock. The company reduced the volumes abstracted in 2016, has announced its plans for further reductions by 2025. Earlier this year, chalk stream degradation across the UK was labelled one of the greatest environmental scandals of this century. There are only 200 chalk streams in the world, 85% of which are in England, but only 25% of those are intact and in a good condition. Councillor Chris Davies, who represents Verulam Ward, said, "With the River Ver crisis and East of England receiving the lowest rainfall across the UK, massive action is required across all centres of influence, which is one of the key reasons why this issue will be on the agenda for the Verulamium Park Consultative Forum."
Next, we have a story about all those brave souls who took part in the Hearts 10K at the weekend. The wind and rain didn't stop the 1,173 runners and walkers at the Hearts 10K this Sunday. Starting and finishing in the grounds of Rothamsted Research in Harpenden, determined participants took on the multi-terrain route in aid of Rennie Grove Hospice Care. The charity's flagship fundraiser draws in runners and walkers of all ages and abilities. The money, raised through entry sign-ups and sponsorships, goes towards the vital services the charity provides for local adults and children living with life-limiting illness and their families across West Harts. Andrew Hughesman initially signed up in January as part of a New Year's resolution, but his reason for running changed after his granddad, John Stevens, passed away in February. "My granddad was cared for in his home in Harpenden by Rennie Grove's Hospice at Home team. He struggled with cancer for over 11 years, and without the help and support of the people at Rennie Grove, he would have found everyday tasks insurmountable." Claire Peacock's family live in Harpenden, so knows how important that Rennie Grove services are. I've had relatives who've needed hospice care, so I'm here to support Rennie Grove and what they do for people in the local area. It was District Councillor Chris Davis's second year at the event. Lawrence Levy, who started the Hearts 10K, is a good friend of mine, and I know Rennie Grove is a charity close to his heart. It's such a great event, and it's amazing to see so many people supporting it. Taking part for the first time was Jo Milligan, with her son Ross and daughters Justine and Cara and their partners. Rennie Grove cared for Jo's mum, Marion Lawrence, after she was diagnosed with motor neurone disease. You don't know how much you will need a service like Rennie Grove's until the time comes. The nurses were incredible and took the weight off by being there when we needed them, day or night. For St Albans resident Tash Underwood, it was her second go taking on the Hearts 10K, but it was all new for Jason Oliveira, who said, "I've not done this before, but Tash encouraged me to sign up. I didn't get a spot in the 2020 London Marathon, but I'm happy to be running here today." A group from Run Redbourne assembled to take on the 10K challenge. Rachel Mackey, who started the running group in 2016, said, "We have connections with Rennie Grove and wanted to take part not just to get fit, but to motivate each other and to raise funds for the charity." Tracy Hancock, director of fundraising at Rennie Grove, said, "I'd like to thank everyone who was involved. Thank you to our founding sponsors, Levy Associates, headline sponsors, Plowman Craven, BP Donoghue and Rothamsted Research for hosting the event. Thank you to Magenta Storage and St Hilda's School. Also, thank you to all the volunteers and marshals who helped on the day." And this is accompanied with a picture of lots of people running the Hearts 10K of all shapes and ages and sizes. But particularly striking is a picture of Andy Bell beaming at 85 years old, having finished the 10K walk, proudly showing his medal.
A car-free day has been backed for St Albans as part of a council bid to put the spotlight on climate change and the environment. Other UK cities, such as London and Edinburgh, have already held car-free days, and Labour councillor Malachi Pakenham has now presented the idea to a meeting of St Albans District Council. The event could not be held without the support of Hertfordshire County Council in its role as Highways Authority. The District Council will now approach the county in a bid to develop plans for a St Albans District car-free day in 2020. At the meeting, Councillor Pakenham, who has never owned a car, said the Roman city was never designed for the volume of cars today. He pointed to the over-usage of cars and to a recent study that suggests the average speed for motorists in St Albans is just 18 miles per hour. He suggested that the council seeks to hold an annual car-free day to encourage residents to think about car usage, and stressed that the motion was not designed to dictate to people that they should not use cars, but to nudge them to think about their actions. Backing the motion, Liberal Democrat council leader, Councillor Chris White, said he would be interested to talk to councillors further to determine whether this should be district-wide. Conservative Councillor Mary Maynard said this was an excellent motion on an issue which should concern us all. She pointed to the high levels of car ownership in St Albans, meaning that in many instances, cars are used for just one person rather than families. However, she cautioned against making this mandatory, saying some residents would resist and that people who lived a few miles out of the city would struggle to comply. Liberal Democrat Councillor Liz Needham said, "There's no implication that people are going to be forced to give up their cars. There won't be any petrol stations or car parks closed. If people choose on the day to use their cars, there will be nothing to stop them. It is just a token gesture." Meanwhile, Independent and Green Councillor Simon Grover said the nervousness from the proposal for one car-free day was an indication of the challenge the council has in meeting climate change targets.
The closure of an indoor soft play centre in Harpenden has met with an outpouring of fond memories from local families. Big Space Harpenden, which is based on Southdown Industrial Estate, announced on Facebook that it will permanently close on Sunday, December the 1st. The owners explained that the landlords have decided to close the centre with a view to redeveloping their part of the site. They said, sadly, after 14 years of trading, we will close our doors for the final time at 4 p.m. on December the 1st, 2019. Please come and visit at some point over the next 7 weeks and have your final play at Big Space, or at least have a last ride down the pink wavy slide. The company confirmed that any birthday parties booked up until the closing date are secure, and they'll continue to take party bookings until that date. More than 400 people commented on Big Space's Facebook post to say that they were sad to see the centre close. Bonnie Benelli commented, "Our grandson Jack will be devastated. Thank you for being there and allowing nannies like me to have such fun bonding with them by bouncing on the bouncy castle with them, sliding down the big slide and generally tiring us all out. We've had many a fun time with you." Rachel Davison said, "My family have been regular customers since my daughter was born 6 years ago. It has sometimes felt like a second home, hosting regular play dates and at least 3 birthday parties. The cleanest and friendliest soft play I know, with a cafe that rivals well-known high street cafes, in my opinion. Big Space has kept me sane through a fair few sleep-deprived years. So sad to see it go." A Harpenden Town Council spokesperson said, "We're always sad to see popular local businesses close. We'll be watching carefully for any future development proposals, as the industrial estate is an important employment location for the town. The neighbourhood plan, which was developed by the town council alongside the community, sets out that this location should be protected to help ensure that Harpenden retains a small but productive amount of employment floor space."
A well-known St Albans motor dealer has died at the age of 91. Don Kendall, owner of Cooper's on Catherine Street, passed away on September the 18th. He took over Cooper's from the previous well-known owner Mike Cooper, a local Rolls-Royce and Bentley dealer and former Monte Carlo rally driver. Don was born in Liverpool and attended Quarry Bank School where Beatle John Lennon was a pupil. In his younger years, he joined the RAF for his national service, where he qualified as a radio instructor and rose to the ranks of corporal. He then moved to London in 1952 and worked in the furniture trade, even being trusted enough to drive his boss's Bentley down to the south of France. His entrepreneurial spirit was beginning to come to the fore when he bought his first company, Offord's, which held a royal warrant for the repair and maintenance of royal coaches and cars. While attending the West End show Grab Me a Gondola, he spotted a young dancer called Lorna, whom he later married. The couple had 2 sons together, Stephen and Paul. Don started Body Shop Donovan Kendall Limited in Watford in the 1960s, and in the 1970s bought Cooper's car dealership in St Albans. His son said that though these businesses were very successful, Don was sometimes not the easiest person to work for, as he was a tough boss but was always fair. Paul said in his eulogy, he loved his cars, American V8s, but especially Rolls-Royces and Bentleys. At one stage, he had over 15 cars. I remember Dad taking me out in a Mustang and the thrill we had at going over 100 miles an hour for the first time down the dual carriageway in Watford, all of course with no seat belts. As well as his love for cars, Don also enjoyed art, had many friends and a close family. Paul added, "I have taken just a few words from his many friends, letters and cards that he was kind, generous, supportive, had a positive impact and was mischievous. Plus one I know he would have loved that he was still very attractive in his 80s. He was a gentleman who really did live his life to the full and took every opportunity that was offered. We all loved him and will miss him greatly, but boy did we enjoy the ride while he was around." And there's a nice picture of Don Kendall accompanying the article.
This piece is about a remarkable young boy who has achieved a black belt in martial arts aged just 9. Deacon Osborne was awarded his black belt on September the 28th in Colney Heath Village Hall. Hatfield-based senior master Kim Anderson, 8th Dan, has been teaching Taekwondo for 40 years and said he has never awarded a black belt to such a young student. One boy of 11 was the previous youngest, and that was more than 30 years ago. Kim said, "I do not normally start students at the age of 5, but Deacon proved his potential at his first trial lesson and his attitude has not changed since the day he started. The highly coveted black belt is not easy to earn, and Deacon proved his worth in passing both the written and practical tests. His result is a true reflection of the amount of effort and hard work that Deacon applies to his Taekwondo, and I am extremely proud to award this to Deacon at the age of just 9. In other news, police have arrested 2 people and seized a vehicle during an operation to crack down on fly tippers in Harpenden. Between 10 a.m. and midday on October the 9th, a 55-year-old man was arrested for driving while disqualified and a 49-year-old woman was arrested for possession of a suspected fraudulent insurance certificate. Both have been released under investigation. Officers from the Harpenden and St Albans Safer Neighbourhood teams were joined by colleagues from the Environment Agency, the Driver and Vehicle Standards Agency and St Albans District Council in Redbourne Lane. A Ford Transit van was seized as the driver was disqualified from driving and had no insurance, and one vehicle was prohibited due to having 2 illegal tyres and was unable to leave until 2 new tyres were fitted. Several other vehicles needed to have defects fixed within 7 days, including a badly cracked windscreen. 3 motorists were also reported for driving without insurance, and others were dealt with for carrying waste without the correct documentation.
Daredevils are invited to hot-foot it across burning coals and raise money for charity in the process. This ultimate test of mind over matter is taking place in Verulamium Park on November the 2nd in aid of the Hospice of St Francis. There will be a short period of training before the firewalk to get participants in the right frame of mind for braving the scorching challenge, and then they will be given the opportunity to walk across a 20-foot fire lane, which reaches temperatures of 1,236 degrees Fahrenheit. This charity supports over 150 people a year from the St Albans area, offering care in its beds for those with a life-limiting illness. It also offers free care for anyone who has had a cancer diagnosis or progressive illness and needs practical and emotional support. Hospice events manager Claire Jones said, "The hospice relies on the support of St Albans residents, so we're able to support patients locally. We'd love local people to get involved in this new fundraising initiative, and we'll be with you every step of the day as you firewalk for us." One of the hospice's recent patients was St Albans resident Elizabeth Burdiner, who died earlier this year, but said, "Before I was admitted, I couldn't eat. My breathing was really difficult, and I had absolutely no quality of life. I could barely walk to the shops, and people kept stopping to ask what was wrong. The local cancer nurses came and said I should be referred to the hospice immediately for assistance. I'd always said if ever I needed a hospice, it had to be St Francis, as it has such a wonderful reputation. And I'm glad to say the care really has been amazing. 6 stars. Anyone over the age of 16 is welcome to sign up, and participants will also secure free entry to the annual St Albans firework display in the park, which takes place after the charity challenge at 7:30 p.m. Registration is £30, and there is a minimum sponsorship amount of £100. To find out more about the firewalk, visit St Francis's website.
Harpenden pupils scooped multiple awards at the UK Go Championships in Cambridge. Go is a 2-player strategy board game which originated in China, and heats are held at individual schools with a final held annually. Pupils from Sir John Law's school were crowned overall UK Go Challenge School champions, and Harpenden Academy pupils were champions in the primary school category. Oliver Bardsley from Sir John Law's won Best Under 12 Boy, and Emily and Auden Olivier from Harpenden Academy won Best Under 10 and Best Under 8 Girl respectively. Ellis Martin, also from Harpenden, won a prize for 3 wins. Mike Coburn, St Albans Go Club president and coach for both school teams, said, "This is an excellent result for both teams and I'm very proud of their achievements. The children have made great progress in learning this complex mind sport."
Hertfordshire Philharmonia will be performing at St Saviour's Church in St Albans this weekend. Conducted by Martin Smith, the orchestra will be playing Vaughan Williams' Pastoral Symphony and Elgar's In the South and Sea Pictures on Saturday, October the 19th at 7:30 p.m. Hearts Philharmonia will be joined by mezzo-soprano Alice Webster. Tickets cost £15, children £1 and students £4. Next week's lunchtime music at St Peter's Church will be provided by pupils from Beaumont School. The Beaumont School vocal ensemble and soloists will return to St Peter's on Wednesday, October the 23rd for their usual lunchtime concert and will perform both sacred and secular works from Mozart to James Macmillan. On Sunday, Odyssey Blues and Soul Band make their debut appearance at the London Road venue at 9 p.m. Next Thursday, October 24th, sees the return of The Hype, who are the latest venture from Andy Wells, drummer from The Slaves.
A story now about swapping slippers. Older and less mobile residents can trade in their old slippers for new ones at a free event in St Albans. The Slipper Swap events will be held at St Albans Library from 10:15 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Friday, November the 1st. Visitors can receive new pairs of anti-slip slippers, have a cup of tea and chat about social groups in their community. The Fire Service, therapists, Neighbourhood Watch and Age UK Hertfordshire will also be on hand to offer advice on staying safe, warm and well during the winter. The charity, Small Acts of Kindness, are providing warm in winter gift bags and library staff will promote services available to older people such as the Home Library Service and Carer's Library Card. Over the years, more than 900 pairs of slippers have been successfully swapped at events throughout Hertfordshire.
And now some radio listings. On Saturday the 19th of October, Clive Anderson and Yolanda Brown are joined by Cara Toynton and Mary Costello in Loose Ends on Radio 4 at 6:15 p.m. Opera on 3 at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 3 is featuring a new production of Handel's work Agrippina, a tense drama of high politics and low deceit, set to some of the composer's most ravishing music. Recorded recently at the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, with the lead taken by mezzo Joyce Di Donato. On BBC Radio 4 Extra at 7 p.m, Michael Palin's Radio Adventures is a programme recorded before a live audience at London's Radio Theatre, celebrating his remarkable life as heard on radio. It features highlights from his diaries, interviews about his comedy and travel work, documentaries about mental illness and much more. Archive on 4 on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. is Aikenfield Now. 50 years after the publication of Ronald Blythe's bestseller Aikenfield, Portrait of an English Village, sixth former Anna Davis and other students visit Charsfield in Suffolk, the real village where the author conducted the interviews on which the book is based, and find out how life has changed there. Blythe himself, now 96, also contributes. And now for Sunday the 20th of October. At midday on Radio 3 in Private Passions, Michael Barclay welcomes actress Selena Cadell, whose many TV appearances include Lab Rats, French and Saunders, and currently as Mrs. Tischel in ITV's Doc Martin. She is also known for stage productions of Shakespeare, Chekhov and Alan Bennett, and also directs drama and opera. Her varied choices include a recording of Keats by her godfather, Ralph Richardson. Jazz Record Requests on Radio 3 at 4 p.m. includes recordings by Ella Fitzgerald, Stefan Grappelli and Stan Getz. Drama on Three at 7:30pm on Radio 3 presents three plays recorded at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, Summer Hall 2019. All three are thought-provoking pieces looking at both historical and present-day society. And in the same mode, Radio 3's Sunday feature, The Hidden Reservoir, at 6:45pm, is an exploration by Irish author Carlo Gebler of the importance of the psychological legacy left by 50 years from the outbreak of the Troubles in Northern Ireland.
A look now at programmes that run on each day through the week from Monday. The book of the week is Homecoming on Radio 4 FM at 9:45am. Gathering together a wealth of testimony from those who came to Britain between the late 1940s and early 60s, Colin Grant presents a rich tapestry of the West Indian migrant experience, which is read by a selection of actors. At 10:45am and repeated at 7:45pm, Radio 4 continues the dramatisation of Edna O'Brien's 1962 novel, The Country Girls, The Lonely Girl. And then Radio 3's Composer of the Week is Giacomo Puccini. Donald MacLeod is joined at the Royal Opera House by conductor Antonio Pappano to trace the developmental line of Puccini's meticulously crafted dramatic heroines. At 1:45pm on Radio 4, Tunnel 29 is a new series of 10 episodes of the extraordinary tale told by journalist Helena Merriman of an East German student, Joachim Neumann, who escaped to the West in the early days of the Berlin Wall and then decided to dig a tunnel back to the East to help others to follow him. The book at bedtime on Radio 4 at 10:45pm is Rabbit Remembered. Toby Jones reads from US novelist John Updike's 2001 novella that revisits the Angstrom family 10 years after Harry's death.
And now some picks for each day from Monday to Friday. For Monday, the 21st of October, on Radio 4 at 11am in Middlesbrough, Money and Me, Steph McGovern, presenter of Business and Finance on BBC's Breakfast programme, returns to her hometown of Middlesbrough to ask why people are not better equipped to work out their finances. This is Radio Times Pick of the Week. While on Radio 4 at 8pm in the first of a two-part programme, Gordon Carrera examines the secret history of GCHQ. In this first episode, he hears from people who worked at the listening station in Scarborough during the Second World War, the Cold War, and the Cuban Missile Crisis. This programme is repeated at 11am on Wednesday. For Tuesday, the 22nd of October, The Hand Detectives is a documentary on Radio 4 at 11am, which explores the science of hand identification. Professor Sue Black, doyen of anatomical forensics, explains the technique which has helped to identify suspects, particularly in high-profile child sex abuse cases in the UK. She is helping to design a computer to help the police so that they don't have to look at harrowing images. There are disturbing moments, but the information presented is fascinating. Another fascinating documentary is on the BBC World Service at 1:30pm and 10:02pm. It follows a young Zoroastrian woman from London called Shazneen, who attends the Youth Congress of the Faith in Los Angeles with a view to finding a life partner during the five-day event in order to satisfy the demands of marrying within her faith, a tall order with only 200,000 Zoroastrians worldwide. Radio 3 in concert at 7:30pm is broadcasting a concert recorded on Saturday at Snape Maltings in Suffolk to celebrate the relationship between Benjamin Britten and his Russian counterpart Shostakovich. Alban Gerhardt on cello is accompanied by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. For Wednesday, the 23rd of October, A new series of The Compass on the BBC World Service at 1:30pm and 10:05pm examines how, more than 30 years since the Berlin Wall fell and the collapse of the USSR, nations caught up in the power games have fared. The first episode is from the Czech Republic and Slovakia. Daliso Chaponda, Citizen of Nowhere, is a new series on Radio 4 at 6:30pm. The Malawian comedian returns for a second series looking at the relationship between the UK and Africa in his own sharp, perceptive and genuinely funny way.
For Thursday the 24th of October. On Radio 3 at 2pm, the afternoon concert is Verdi's Rigoletto, the tragic tale of love, deceit and revenge, recorded last November at the Swedish Royal Opera in Stockholm. On Radio 4 at 3pm, in a new series of Open Country, Rick Stein's Cornwall is the first episode. In the 1970s, Rick Stein opened a nightclub in Padstow which was shut down because of the rowdy behaviour of the drunken fishermen. To avoid bankruptcy, he turned it into a restaurant, and those fishermen became his suppliers. He recalls his long history with Cornwall. At 11pm, also on Radio 4, The Nether Regions is a one-off comedy sketch show written and performed by Rob Grant and Andrew Marshall, both with decades of comedy writing experience. For Friday, the 25th of October, on Radio 4 at 7:15pm in Front Row, Stig Abel talks to the legendary director Peter Brook, still active at the age of 94. He talks about his decades of work in the theatre and film industry. Radio 3, in concert, at 7:30pm, presents a recreation of a 1960 concert that took place at the Royal Festival Hall in London, when Benjamin Britten attended the premiere of Shostakovich's Cello Concerto on an evening that also featured in Britten's own Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra. This concert was recorded on Sunday at Snape Maltings in Suffolk. And finally, on Radio 2 at 8pm, Friday Night is Music Night, is inspired by the current release of Rupert Gould's biopic Judy. Radio 2 offers another chance to hear a celebration of two of the most influential singers of the 20th century, Judy Garland and Frank Sinatra. First broadcast in January with the BBC Concert Orchestra and singers, it's conducted by Richard Balcom.
The day Somebody McSomebody put a gun to my breast and called me a cat and threatened to shoot me was the same day the milkman died.
I'm here today with Claire Hobber, who's a local teacher and writer, and she suggested that we talk about a book which has had quite a bit of publicity for reasons we'll come to. It's called Milkman.
The author is Anna Burns. She's writing as an 18-year-old young woman in this book, but in fact, she herself is in middle age and has had a life where she's been learning her trade and her craft, and it all really comes to play in the amazing prose and story of this novel and the way it's delivered. Her own story actually has been a little bit of a fairy tale in the end, although she's been through very hard times. She's been living on people's sofas. She's been eating from a food bank. But in 2018, Anna Burns won the Man Booker Prize with Milkman. So her persistence and her integrity has been rewarded, not something that always happens.
The book tells us where it comes from, which is also where she came from, isn't it? I mean, she was herself from Northern Ireland,
Northern
from Belfast.
Indeed, although that's one of the interesting and contentious parts of the novel, that the place is never mentioned. Those of us who watched all the footage in the 1970s and 80s during the Trouble on the television will recognise the scenes and the issues of Belfast. But I understand that younger people who are reading this novel now, to whom all that is foreign, are assuming that it's a dystopian novel rather in the way that The Handmaid's Tale is. And they can see that this is some sort of society that has been warped by circumstances. So she's telling it very much on two levels. She does pin it down. She has references to the 1970s, like Sigourney Weaver and Freddie Mercury and Kate Bush, and mentions of the Cold War. So if you're looking for the references, they are there. But it also has a resonance way beyond that. It's almost like a study of how people will behave when put under these strange circumstances of the Troubles.
And perhaps we can come to some of the strange circumstances that arise within that dystopian context, or the stressful context, call it what you will, because what frightens the life out of me at the moment, and I'm thinking of where we are now at the moment, talking of, well, does it matter whether Ireland is thrown back into the Troubles again? Well, this book is a very timely reminder, actually. Whether or not the book is about Ireland doesn't matter, because it gives us a picture of what some of us remember of those days. In the opening section, we have a very strange starting the day. Somebody McSomebody. It's a very odd sort of phrase. Now, what's she on about?
Well, this is one of the symptoms of living in a tightly knit community, which is almost turned in on itself.
The day Somebody McSomebody put a gun to my breast and called me a cat and threatened to shoot me was the same day the milkman died. He had been shot by one of the state hit squads, and I did not care about the shooting of this man. Others did care, though. And some were those who, in the parlance, knew me to see but not to speak to. And I was being talked about because there was a rumour started by them, or more likely by first brother-in-law, that I had been having an affair with this milkman, and that I was 18 and he was 41. I knew his age not because he got shot and it was given by the media, but because there had been talk before this, for months before the shooting, by these people of the rumour, that 41 and 18 was disgusting. The 23 years difference was disgusting. That he was married and not to be fooled by me, for there were plenty of quiet, unnoticeable people who took a bit of watching. It had been my fault too, it seemed, this affair with the milkman. But I had not been having an affair with the milkman. I did not like the milkman, and had been frightened and confused by his pursuing and attempting an affair with me.
There are no names within this book. People are known only by their role within the society or by their nickname. So even our protagonist, we never learn her name, not even her Christian name. She is known throughout the book as Middle Sister. And Somebody McSomebody is a wannabe Republican paramilitary who actually is all mouth. And many of the characters in the book are known by their relationship to Middle Sister. So she goes running with third brother-in-law, and she has various other relatives. And also people are sometimes known by the odd things that they do. So there is Nuclear Boy, who spends all his life in terrible fear of nuclear war breaking out as a consequence of the Cold War, and as obsessed by that. And there is Tablets Girl, who, again, it's interesting that she is even at large, because she's a mentally disturbed young woman who is a poisoner. So she slips things into people's drinks. For all it's a condemning and a harsh society, they also somehow seem to manage to sustain people who perhaps in another society would have been put away.
Yes, and the names, as you said, they're either characteristics of the person or something, the role. And we're told in the very beginning it was the same day the milkman died.
That's his name, and without any real reason, seemingly, that seems to be what he's come to be called. So there is also a real milkman in the book who actually delivers milk, but this guy, his role is as powerful paramilitary chieftain, presumably the IRA, and basically he is a big man in that town, and he can do what he wants and he can get who he wants, and if you cross him you're likely to suffer a shooting or a car bomb. And he takes a fancy to our protagonist without her ever wittingly doing anything to attract him. She's a girl in her late teens. We glean that she's got long blonde hair. Perhaps that was enough to do it for him. And he kind of appears in her life out of nowhere and will not take no for an answer. He grooms her. He takes it for granted that one day she will be his. And she is flabbergasted and doesn't know what to do. And worst of all, because he appears regularly now in her company, what he's doing is trying to mesmerise her and groom her and persuade her into a relationship. But people seeing them together presume that the relationship has already started. again, how relevant this novel is in a time of Brexit. It's also relevant in the year of Me Too, because this is a girl who is suffering under the power of a man. And one phrase that she uses, she says, "Because I was confused and becoming enfeebled, shut down by the tactics of this milkman." And she expresses the powerlessness, particularly before the Me Too movement, of a young girl being groomed by an older man.
And that is the reality of the power structure. And so this sort of community, they're very important women in there.
Women always broke the curfews. That would be the traditional women, because until recently, there hadn't been any newfangled branch of sisterhood women. This breaking of the curfews, too, would be because the traditional women's patience would have been stretched far enough. It would have been overtried, overtested, and the subsequent snapping of it would be directed towards any group of men, any religion, any side of the water, setting up rules and regulations, overreaching themselves with their rules and regulations, expecting everyone else too, meaning women, to go along with the preposterousness, the silliness they had concocted as rationale in their heads.
They're powerful in their own right because they are the head of household, or they're working well, they're keeping things safe that would not otherwise be safe, but they're having to watch their backs all the time. And she has problems because she does things that are not quite normal.
Again, as we mentioned with Tablet Girl, you can be beyond the bounds of what people consider normal. But strangely, she is still tolerated. Now, it's really interesting. What puts her beyond the pale? That's the phrase they use, meaning beyond the boundaries. And the thing that she does when she's walking is something that the author, in fact, herself admitted to doing. She reads while walking, and people mention to her that this is not normal. And her best friend, known simply in the book as Friend, takes her to task, says she's put herself beyond the pale.
"Often I would walk along reading books. I didn't see anything wrong with this, but it became something else to be added as further proof against me. Reading while walking was definitely on the list."
It's dangerous behaviour because it means she's not alert to what's going on around her. So in a situation where there is warfare waged at a low level the whole time, including shootings, including bombings, you don't want to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. You don't want to become collateral damage or walk in on a situation. So this reading by walking is actually dangerous in a way that we today in the UK possibly don't even imagine. But it just is also unusual. It draws attention to her. People look at her and think she's a bit odd. And it's really interesting as well what she's reading. She's reading 19th century novels, and she does explain that she finds it very difficult to live in the time, in the place that she's been placed in. It's escapist behaviour. So it's no wonder then that she's not reading 20th century novels. She's reading Victorian splendid works of literature like the Brontes and taking herself to a different place and a different time.
And as for vigilance or non-vigilance, for switching off or not switching off, it was my opinion that with my reading while walking, I was doing both at the same time. And why should I not? I knew that by reading while I walked, I was losing touch in a crucial sense with communal up-to-dateness. And that that indeed was risky.
Reading 19th century novels while walking along through the streets of a city that may or may not be Belfast, it feels awfully like it, at a very difficult time, and we would call it the Troubles. And you do that not only if you, it's dangerous to do that because of the reasons you said, you're not observing what's going on around you, and you need to be very observant in that sort of situation, but also because it makes you feel different, and people don't like people who are different because they're a threat. And ironically, she is the least threatening person. She has a boyfriend. She calls him maybe boyfriend.
Indeed.
Because again, that's his role. Is he or isn't he, as it were? There's that question mark, isn't there? But she would be very happy with him. But he's a bit of a risk as well.
That's right, exactly. And it's absolutely farcical the way he comes to notice. And it is that they're taking to bits a car, and part of the car has the badge, which is a British manufacturer. And he is actually a car mechanic who stores and reuses parts of cars. And the bit with the badge on it falls to him. And that can be seen as a sign that he supports the English. So it, unwittingly, he puts himself at risk in that way. And he also, in a way that he doesn't actually realise, is at risk because the milkman begins to make threats that he'll leave a car bomb under his car or otherwise deal with maybe boyfriend so that he will get out of middle sister's way and leave her to the milkman. So a young man who doesn't even realise he's in danger there.
But she's also very bright. She's clearly got a high IQ, high understanding, but she's not getting opportunity to explore that.
No, she wanted to go to Greek and Roman class, I think, or Greek and Roman culture. That's what she wanted to do. But in a common trope in this book, she denies herself the things she really wants to do and goes to French classes to try and develop herself. There's an interesting instance in the French class of the small-mindedness of the people in that community. The teacher is trying to get them to describe the sunset, which is happening before their very eyes outside the classroom window, and is asking them what colour the sky is. And they are not looking. They are feeding back to her the knowledge that they know to be true. The sky is blue. They're very disturbed by the fact that she's trying to get them to see other colours in the sky. They will allow that at night the sky is black, that sometimes there is white in the sky, which is clouds, but otherwise the sky is blue.
"Tell me, class," she said. "What colours? Do you hear that? Colours, plural, do you see now?" We looked because she made us, even though sunsets weren't part of our curriculum. But we looked, and it seemed to us that the sky, as usual, was turning from light blue to dark blue, which meant it was just blue. I knew, though, since that recent alarming and alerting sunset I'd experienced with maybe boyfriend, that that sky that night in the French class was neither those shades of blue. A person of any level of contrariness or entrenchment might have been pushed to find any blue in the whole of our class's window. We were pushed. Also, we were adamant. "Blue. Blue." Perhaps a bit, "No, blue," came our all-out replies.
So it's a really powerful illustration of how even somebody who's trying to educate and expand horizons finds it very difficult in this inward-looking, threatened community. It's not just that they are not outward-looking. I think that is also coerced by the threat of violence. And also, when you look outside, who is the power to whom you might appeal? We are looking at the Roman Catholic community here. Not that it ever says it. It calls them the state renouncers. So that's Roman Catholic Republican to you and I guess. And they actually can't access the power structures that should help an ordinary citizen. So to the extent that when somebody is really ill, they still don't visit the hospital because that is a state institution. So it's not for the likes of them. That's for the Protestants. But
there's also a sense in which they don't go to hospital because it's part of the state, but also because if they step inside that, they then might have done something or said something or become something. They might have been stepped over into the state side.
Yep.
Therefore, they become a threat to the people who control their own community.
So they're wary of looking like traitors.
That's right.
Go.
So if you're not with us, you're against us. She describes walking through certain areas, and the landscape is quite important, isn't it? We know that it's going to be fairly rough, fairly bombed out, fairly dark. Mm. There's various sections where she describes the landscape. Do you think the landscape comes through very well?
I think it's very analogous to the way that people are named by their roles or by their relationships. The landscape is named by the things that happen there. And it even reminds me of the Australian Aborigines describe their landscape in terms of stories and things that happened rather than a two-dimensional map. So you have places like the 10-minute area because it's a place that you just want to get through and that takes about 10 minutes.
The 10-minute area was, and always had been, some bleak, eerie, Mary Celeste little place. It was shaped in a round, dominated by three giant churches spaced closely and evenly about its centre. These churches had long been out of action, disused, defeated, almost shells of buildings, though their black spires still towered up there in the sky. As a child, I used to imagine those towers trying to touch tips, to converge, to make a witch's hat which everybody would then be forced to walk through. That had been the first noticeable thing for me all those years ago about this little place. Apart from the witch's hat, there were few other buildings, and what there were also seemed deserted. Supposed offices, a few residences, with nobody appearing to live in them or to work in them, and people, should you happen to come across any like you, would have their heads down as they too went hurrying by.
And there's the usual place, which is the graveyard, isn't it? Which I think is probably the usual place that people either are shot or where the body is found or where people are summoned to when they're in trouble. It's never fully explained why it's the usual place, but you can imagine. They almost don't need outside reference and addresses because everybody they know is within this community and knows the same history and knows the same thoughts.
Possibly somebody listening to us talk about this. I mean, we've had the benefit of having read it and having listened to the audio version, or some of it anyway. And it could be that we give the impression it's quite complicated. Actually, it's complex in the sense it's got lots of references and lots of things to think about.
Mm.
But I think you said to me that you've gone back to it and looked at it again. You realise how good it is.
I'm really very grateful to have been able to do this because it meant that I looked in more detail and I'm just completely convinced. I think one of the massive gifts of the book is the voice of the protagonist of Middle Sister. And as you can hear in the extracts, Northern Irish, an accent that you hear in your ears as you're reading the book. But very much it's the concerns and the voice of this 18-year-old girl, but an 18-year-old girl who's an autodidact. She's educated herself with her 19th century novels that she reads while walking. So she's got an extraordinary vocabulary, but totally accounted for. We know exactly where she got that vocabulary from. And she tells most of the story in an indignant tone. The whole story is her protesting against what's happening to her with the milkman. And it is just like listening to somebody telling you their story. It's not hard to read or hard to understand. It flows beautifully.
And I think that's one of its great successes, that it is so enjoyable to listen to. And I think I've heard more of the audio version than you have. And it really just flows. And you think, gosh, I don't want to put this down. I don't want to stop it. And I think that's great. And obviously the judges of the Man Booker felt it was pretty successful as well. So Claire and I have been talking about Milkman by Anna Burns, which was awarded the Man Booker Prize 2018. An earlier work of hers, No Bones, I think was her first novel, was shortlisted for the Orange Prize. She's had a few other awards as well. Great writer, great piece of listening as well as reading. Thank you very much, Claire.
Thank you, Rob.
Milkman was read by Breeze Brennan, and the audiobook lasts for just over 14 hours, but well worth every minute. Our thanks to Calibre Audio for allowing us to use those extracts.
Hello, I'm Hilary, and now I'm going to read an article from Hertfordshire Life, all about Cresta Silks. The pursuit of quality in everything, and to place the creative artist at the centre of business. These were the founding principles of Tom Herron's Cresta Silks. For decades, the women's fashion company he founded in Welwyn Garden City 90 years ago was a go-to for style. But Herron was an unusual businessman, combining socialist principles, a love of craftsmanship, and commercial realism to form Cresta. It was fitting, then, that he chose the Garden City to relocate from Cornwall. The town was built on much the same foundations. The company made ladies' clothes and accessories from high-quality silks specially woven on old looms at Arnold Wright's silk mill in Dorset. Stylish modernism was at the heart of everything Cresta did. Tom Herron was an artist, a businessman, and a social reformer. He had previously managed the textile company Chrysaid in Cornwall, which was run by the artist Alec Walker. In 1929, Walker suffered a breakdown and fired Herron. Herron settled on Welwyn Garden City as the location for his new company, as purpose-built units on Broadwater Road were big enough to accommodate a flourishing business, alongside his appreciation of town founder Ebenezer Howard's vision. Cresta Silks employed many local people, as well as bringing new employees to the area. The workforce was mainly female, and girls, straight from school, would start their career here. Herron had an eye for talent and was able to develop a dedicated workforce. He believed in fair play, healthy working conditions, and generous holidays for his staff. He employed female managers, which was very rare at the time. Heron's views made him popular with the staff, with one employee describing him as a marvellous but strict boss. She even said that at work you were allowed to sing but not talk. Tom Heron wanted every aspect of Cresta to be stylish and modern. He took a risk and commissioned the inexperienced architect Wells Coates to design shops, workrooms and furniture for the company. Coates used inexpensive materials, including plywood, glass and metal, to create sleek, clean interiors. Shops were set up in affluent shopping areas such as Bond Street, Brighton and Bournemouth. In the workroom, large windows let in lots of light to improve conditions and show the fabric colours in their true light. Coates is now one of the best-known architects of the modernist movement. Heron also employed artist and graphic designer Edward McKnight Kaufner to design a logo, lettering and packaging for the company. The American designed London transport posters in the 1930s and is known for his clean lines and modern style. For over 30 years, Cresta's hallmark was its exquisite hand block print designs. A very time-consuming and skilled technique, block printing creates bright, vibrant colours. Each section of a design was hand-carved into wood blocks. These blocks would then be coated in thick ink, placed onto the silk and struck with a mallet to drive the dye into the fabric. Cresta designs were wide-ranging in style and colour and were used on clothes, accessories and even furniture. Tom Heron commissioned many well-known artists to produce textile designs, including Cedric Morris, best known for his abundant floral paintings, and the abstract artist Graham Sutherland, and perhaps best known, Paul Nash. Heron liked to use his fame in advertising, saying, "We employ designers like Paul Nash." Nash objected to this, saying there were no other designers like him. Heron and his wife, Orly, nurtured an artistic spirit in their son, Patrick. In 1934, at the age of 14, he designed his first Cresta scarf, called Melon. Patrick produced many designs, and this influence can be seen in his use of colour and shapes in his later works as a renowned artist in his own right. Today, many of Patrick Heron's abstract works, colourful, bold dabs, dashes and strokes, are in the Tate collection. With the start of the Second World War, the government commandeered silk for parachutes. Cresta's premises were taken over and its workers reassigned to war work. An adaptable businessman, Heron traded in wool instead and was key in the creation of the utility clothing scheme, which produced stylish yet functional wartime clothing. After the war, Heron bought shares in another textile company to form Cressida Criseida Properties. Heron's son, Patrick, became chief designer and new man-made fabrics and quicker printing techniques were set up to reduce costs. This new approach would make Cresta one of the most successful and iconic British textile companies of the period. The company grew rapidly into a national brand. For Tom Heron, the highlight was in 1953 when Cresta created a limited edition silk scarf to celebrate the coronation of the Queen. Heron employed set designer Oliver Messel to produce a design featuring the Queen's gold state coach, finished with gold leaf. The piece was featured on the cover of British Vogue in April 1953 and was reissued in white in 1977 for the Queen's Silver Jubilee. In 1953, Tom Heron retired and employed Eric Crabtree as manager. This was a time of great change and growth for the company. By 1973, there were 80 shops across the country and well over 1,000 employees. Cresta finally ceased trading in the late 1970s when it was sold to Debenhams. There's an exhibition on Cresta Silks, Cresta Couture, Designing Fashion Inspired by Nature, at the Mill Green Museum and Mill in Hatfield until November the 10th. In the displays, Wellin Hatfield Museum Service, in partnership with the University of Hertfordshire, celebrate the innovative and stylish fabrics created by the company. Alongside original garments, university fashion design students have explored how Cresta prints can be reimagined for the contemporary market with their own designs.
We're coming to the end of this week's programme. Thanks as ever to all our contributors, including our readers, Hilary, Caroline, Bob and Lucy. And as ever, thank you very much for listening. We close with Lord Franklin by me. I hope you enjoy it. Goodbye.
'Twas homeward bound one night on the deep. Swinging in my hammock, I fell asleep. I dreamed a dream and I thought it true. Concerning Franklin and his gallant crew. With 100 seamen he sailed away to the frozen ocean in the month of May, to seek a passage around the pole, we poor seamen do sometimes go. Through cruel hardships they mainly strove. The ship on mountains of ice was drove. Only the Eskimo in his skin canoe, only one who ever came through. To Franklin, no man may know. Fate of Franklin, no tongue can tell. Franklin alone with his sailors do dwell. And now my burden, it gives me pain. My Lord Franklin, I'd cross the main. 10,000 pounds would I freely give to say on earth that my Franklin do.